Was macht denn ihr da?
Design.
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 Machen.
Machen. Machen.
Gesellschaft.
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 Ja, ich bin heute im Kornhaus Forum in Bern beim alljährlichen Master Design Festival der HKB. Letztes Jahr war ich als Mad-Student noch selbst in der Rolle des Gastgebers an diesem Ort, als wir mit unserem Jahrgang diesen Event gestalten mussten bzw. durften. Jedes Jahr suchen sich die Studierenden ein übergreifendes Thema aus, zu dem unterschiedliche Expertinnen aus verschiedensten Fachrichtungen der Designsphäre referieren, kreieren oder Workshops veranstalten. Die diesjährige Ausgabe widmet sich dem Thema Träume. Neben mir sitzt Miriam Koban, und wir sind soeben in den Genuss ihrer Keynote gekommen mit dem vielversprechenden Titel Be Realistic, Design the Impossible. Hallo Miriam, schön, dass du hier bist. Den Leuten vom Institute of Design Research bist du natürlich ein bekanntes Gesicht. Aber für all unsere Hörerinnen, die dich und deine Arbeit noch nicht kennen, magst du dich kurz vorstellen, mal sagen, wer du bist und was dich wissenschaftlich so umtreibt?
Ja, gern. Hallo allerseits und eben danke erstens mal für die Einladung zu diesem Mad Festival. Ich habe das schon in meiner Keynote gesagt, ich habe eine sehr emotionale Bindung zu diesem Masterstudiengang und auch zu den Studierenden. Und danke eben auch für diese interessante Einstiegsfrage, über sich selber zu sprechen. Das ist ja oft gar nicht so schwierig. Ich werde es ganz probieren, kurz und interessant zu machen und nicht so akademisch, weil eigentlich, ist das andere, was man ja so macht, viel interessanter. Also, mein Name ist Miriam Koban. Ich bin im Moment Doktorandin am Institute of Design Research. In meiner Dissertation überlege ich eigentlich, wie die Alternativszene und die Protestkultur der 1980er Jahre, also der Jugendbewegung in der Schweiz, sich auf das Grafikdesign ausgewirkt hat, auf den Beruf, auf das Verständnis von Grafikdesign. Das ist auch so ein bisschen etwas, was mich im Moment sehr antreibt, irgendwie die Grenzen von Disziplinen ein bisschen auszuloten und auch irgendwie auch die transformativen Prozesse, die dahinter sind. Und ich war sehr froh über die Einladung jetzt hier zum Mad Festival, weil es war genau sozusagen der Auftrag an mich, die transformative Kraft von Design ein bisschen zu erforschen, was ich eben auch getan habe. Und vielleicht kann man das jetzt irgendwie zusammenfassen in sagen, Design hat einen reformerischen Gedanken immer schon gehabt, eine transformative Kraft, das ist im Design inhärent. Und ich glaube ganz tief, dass Design transformative Prozesse begleiten kann. Und ich glaube, das ist das Grundmotiv, was mich eigentlich antreibt, in dieser Welt zu forschen.
Ja, du hast das in deinem Vortrag an einem interessanten Beispiel aufgehängt. Du hast eben über den britischen Designer William Morris gesprochen. Kannst du uns vielleicht kurz umreißen, wer er war und vielleicht insbesondere darauf eingehen, aus welchen sozialen Hintergründen er kommt, wenn du das auch recherchiert hast?
Ja, also William Morris war der Begründer der englischen Arts und Crafts Bewegung. Das ist auch eine Reformbewegung, eine Gegenbewegung zum damaligen vorherrschenden Designbild, kann man noch nicht sagen, weil der Designer, die Designerin ist eigentlich so noch nicht, hat es noch nicht gegeben, aber eigentlich eine Kritik gegenüber den herrschenden Konsum- und Produktionsverhältnissen in der Kunstgeschichte und auch in der Designgeschichte fasst man das unter dem Historismus zusammen. Es ist billig produzierte, kurzlebige Möbel, die eben in diesem Drive des der Industrialisierung und das produziert worden sind, einerseits eben auch vorbei an den Bedürfnissen der Menschen und eben andererseits an sehr, sehr billig gestaltet und mit billigen Materialien und kurzer Lebensdauer. Und der reformerische Gedanke von William Morris war eben er war gegen diese Massenproduktion, gegen diese Industrialisierung, sich eigentlich zurückzubesinnen auf das Handwerk und daraus eigentlich Objekte, Designs und aber auch Strukturen und so weiter zu erschaffen, die eben auf die wirklichen Bedürfnisse der Menschen zugeschnitten sind. Und er sah eben in seiner, also er war Sozialist und vielleicht eben auch eher Kommunist, kann man ihn nennen. Er hat an diese klassenlose Gesellschaft geglaubt. Er hat daran geglaubt, dass Egalität eben auch durch die Dinge passiert, die einem umgeben, die die Gesellschaft umgeben. Und in diesem Sinne wollte er eben auch Design produzieren oder handwerkliche Gegenstände produzieren, die eben die Bedürfnisse der Gesellschaft spiegeln. Genau, und das wollte ich nochmal zurückzukommen. Er sah nämlich eigentlich diese Gesellschaft in diese zwei Hälften geteilt, nämlich diese reiche Kapitalisten, Wirtschafts-, soziale Klasse, aber eben auch vor allem die sehr, sehr arme Arbeiterklasse, für die es eigentlich keine oder wenig Bestrebungen gab, ihre Lebensverhältnisse im Zuge der Verarmung, der Urbanisierung, der Verslammung, der langen Arbeitszeiten, der Kindersterblichkeitsrate, der miesen gesundheitlichen Versorgung und so weiter und so fort zu verbessern.
Interessant. Also daraus geht ja auch hervor, um jetzt auch mal beim Stichwort zu bleiben, dass man seinen Approach als Vorläufer eines Transformation Designs bezeichnen kann, wie du das ja auch in deiner Präsentation gesagt hast. Inwiefern sind denn diese Ideen relevant für die, für so zeitgenössische Designmethodologien in diesem Kontext?
Ja, dann gehe ich vielleicht nochmal zurück zu dem, was ich in dem Talk präsentiert habe, nämlich Morris fasst sein Verständnis von Design in dieser Novel zusammen, die er geschrieben hat, 98, News from Nowhere. Und er entwirft da eigentlich eine Gesellschaftsutopie, die auf Egalität basiert, die auf Naturverbundenheit organisiert, die auf Schonung von Ressourcen, natürlichen Ressourcen, sozialen Ressourcen und so weiter basiert. Und diese Art von, also er war so ein bisschen Fortune Teller, diese Art von Problemen, die er da aufzeigt, Ende des 19. Jahrhunderts, die haben wir jetzt Anfang des 21. Jahrhunderts immer noch und die haben sich auch perpetuiert, vergrößert und auf einen global ausgewirkt. Und von dem her gibt es in dem, was man Transformation Design nimmt als neues Designparadigma, das sich eigentlich über alle anderen Designdisziplinen stülpen sollte oder in meiner Ansicht nach sollte, sehr viele Parallelen, oder weil es gibt eben auch, es geht auch um die Frage, wie designen wir denn für eine nachhaltige, sozial gleichberechtigte Gesellschaft? Wie kommen wir denn da, wie kann Design sozusagen diese Transformation begleiten angesichts der Tatsache, dass wir auf einem endlichen Planeten leben, dessen Ressourcen endlich sind und angesichts auch der Tatsache oder dieser Tendenz, dass sich unsere Gesellschaft immer mehr in diese zwei Pole von Reich und Arm und so weiter entwickelt. Also das sind alles Fragen und Sorgen, die Morris schon aufgeworfen hat, die er eigentlich dann in seiner Utopie sozusagen visioniert hat, zu einer idealen Gesellschaft. Und wo ich finde, heute kann man mit Transformation Design, mit diesem Ansatz, wirklich hat man Tools und Prozesse und Methoden bei der Hand, um das auch anzugehen. Wir müssen es jetzt einfach mal machen und das ganzheitlich.
Meine nächste Frage geht jetzt nochmal spezifisch an dich als Designhistorikerin. Utopien folgt ja oft ein Realitätscheck, also ein Abgleichen von Vorstellbarem mit sozusagen Realisierbarem. Würdest du sagen, dass das Design diesen Check von der Disziplinidentität her traditionell übersteht?
Also du meinst, ob es Design nach der Transformation noch gibt? Ja, natürlich. Ich glaube, Design muss sich selber als Disziplin jetzt hinterfragen innerhalb von diesem Transformationsprozess. Was kann es denn leisten? Wie kann es zu diesem Transformationsprozess beitragen? Da wäre zum Beispiel die Auflösung der Disziplinen so ein Thema. Es ist natürlich wichtig, dass man sich in Dingen spezialisiert hat, aber heutzutage auch mit diesen technologischen Revolutionen und so weiter sind vielleicht auch gerade im Ausbildungskontext solche Ausbildungen in diesen Disziplinen vielleicht zu eng gesetzt. Vielleicht müsste man das wie auch überdenken, dass man da transdisziplinärer arbeitet, an und dann beim Stichwort transdisziplinär auch das ernst zu nehmen und sagen, man arbeitet im Bereich Design, der sich aber extrem überschneidet mit anderen Disziplinen wie so den Sozialwissenschaften, wie den Umweltwissenschaften und so weiter, weil man eben diese Transformation ganzheitlich angehen soll, weil diese Transformation alle Bereiche dieses Lebens, unseres Lebens einnimmt und tangiert. Genau, von dem her, es ist wichtig, diese Transformation mit Design zu begleiten, auch angesichts der Tatsache, dass wenn wir uns umschauen, alles, was uns mal direkt vor der Nase ist, designt ist, also das geht wie gar nicht anders. Da spreche ich mal jetzt von diesem auf sichtbaren Design, wie Objekte, wie Printmaterialien oder digitale Materialien, da spreche ich von Medien, da spreche ich von Architektur und so weiter, aber eben auch unsichtbare Prozesse, und Dynamiken, denen wir wie ausgesetzt sind. Das sind alles potenzielle Anwendungsbereiche, wo Designer, DesignerInnen tätig sein müssen, dass sie eben diesen Wandel mitgestalten. Und ich hoffe natürlich, dieser Wandel fällt positiv für uns alle aus, also ich meine wirklich für uns alle global, positiv auch für die Umwelt aus. Und dann müssten wir doch eigentlich auch diesen Standard halten können. Und deswegen wird es immer Designer und DesignerInnen brauchen, die aktiv dazu beitragen, dass wir eine bessere Welt erschaffen. Und das meine ich jetzt nicht im naiven Sinn, sondern in einem wirklich sehr ehrlichen, glaubhaften Sinn.
Das finde ich ein ganz tolles Schlusswort. Ja, danke Miriam für diese spannenden Perspektiven. Ich könnte dir wahrscheinlich noch stundenlang Fragen stellen, aber wir wollen ja schließlich auch noch die anderen Beiträge hören. Ich wünsche dir noch ein ganz, ganz gutes Festival und bis bald.
Danke vielmals. Ich wünsche dir auch noch ein gutes Festival. Danke für das Interview und danke fürs Zuhören. Und ja, ihr seid alle toll.
We'll continue in English. I'm now with Rana Basile. Right after hearing her very engaging, personal and moving presentation titled Dreaming When Everything Fails. To me, a strong point coming from this keynote is the understanding that current design methodologies can hardly function nowadays without considering and implementing post-colonial theories and positions. Hello, Rana. It's very nice to have you here. You obviously are an incredibly active person, both in cultural production and in political activism. You're involved in countless projects such as Belloir Bollwerk, in Fribourg or Cine Résistance in Bern. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your biography, which is extremely important for understanding your contribution and your expertise that we just heard?
Hello, thank you for this. So I studied graphic design and also started working in advertising, but then I understood that I really don't want to work in advertising. I don't want to contribute to make more money to rich people. And I always loved music. So when I arrived to Switzerland, I started to work, to be a volunteer in different clubs. And then from there to there, I got an amazing job. And then, and for me, it's important, like culture. I fight for accessibility of culture, like for like people to be able to go see concerts, to go to museums, to go to theaters, and money. I really hate when money is a like a border of being. Sorry, like my mother tongue is Arabic or French, but. I hate when if you don't have money, you cannot access culture. And this is something I fight for. That's why I shifted in culture politics, in advocacy with Betsy, because I believe in this, because I believe also culture changes societies. And for example, in Peru, I think, they put like free card for teenagers to go to museums and to go to a lot of cultural places, and they noticed after a few year, maybe 1 year, that the delinquency and was way less than before, because these kids were not on the streets anymore. They managed to to reduce this. So I do believe in the strength of this culture and politics.
Wonderful. Thank you for this insight. Can you maybe elaborate a bit more on the connection between design and political activism, and especially the concept of home and belonging, as you stated in your presentation?
I mean, political activism is what designs societies. It's how you want to see your country. Do you want a free place? Do you want a place? Do you want equality? Do you want people to feel good? Or you want to create a system of control and a police system? And so this is how politics can design a society. But for that, also you need people who have these ideas to be there, which the system now is designed not to let them be in the system. So it's like a vicious circle, but it needs also lots of patience. And I always ask myself, where is home? I really don't know where is home, because in Lebanon, after 17 years now, I think, okay, maybe it's not home anymore. And here I don't feel it's home anymore. But then I think you design also your own home, where you belong through. For me, home is where the community is, where the people I love, they live, and I can feel safe with them. And home is a place also that makes me feel safe and welcome. So, it's a very big topic, home. I think this is the topic of my life every day. Where is home? Where do I want to die? Where I want to be buried or not? So these are very, very big ideas. I cannot have one answer to. But this is how I feel now.
Talking about your personal experiences, war and displacement and coping with with collapsing systems, how today contribute to your approach in creating and fostering resilient communities? And how do you think design plays a role in that process? Or you talked in your presentation about nurturing communities that give home and a sense of belonging to you. You did that. You talked about an example in Fribourg. What do you think is the role of design in there, in your understanding?
Again, I think it's designing your life in a very meta answer. I don't know how design contributes to this, but it does. Because we created this community out of people we don't know, a few people adding other Arabs, adding other Arabs to a group, and we became it's one of the best things that happened and that shifted my life, that deconstructed my life and redesigned it somehow, and other people's lives. I've never had this experience before on how this community living. I mean, I had it maybe when I was younger, but now at this age, and when you feel so alone, this community, these people coming together out of grief, became it makes me very emotional, because it gave a sense to belong here now, and it changed the design of each of our life, which changed the design of other people's lives, and then it's a domino effect maybe, because some of us were new here, some of us are here since a long time, and we could also give our expertise or help in things, and other people managed to stay in Switzerland because we helped with the housewives or things like this. So it's a design, it's a complex maybe design, I don't know, but it's
I see. It's a tricky question.
So
for a last question, is there a piece of advice you maybe would like to share with young people, especially involved in resistance and political activism?
Oh, a lot. But I think is when people start to love you, it means you're doing it wrong. When you are the black sheep and like people always are a bit scared because you're gonna talk, it means you're on the right way. But always be radical, and this is what's important.
Good one. Thank you so much. So yeah, thank you for these fascinating insights, and again for your very powerful and touching presentation. I hope you have a very pleasant evening, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So the next guest I'm talking to is Patricia Guaita. She's an architect, researcher, and educator at the EPFL in Lausanne. Today, she held an intriguing presentation about experimental construction sites in Latin America. Patricia, first of all, it's very nice to meet you. I know this is a tricky question, but can you yourself briefly summarize what you talked about in your keynote?
Yes, sure. Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with you. What we are trying to test and investigate in the talk is how students from Switzerland that are know much more about high technologies, how they react in a way in the middle of the desert in another cultural ground, and trying to redefine, thanks to the open city and all the cultural that they have, different ways of building. And for example, we, in a way, what I wanted to share with the audience was that we discovered different actions that now actually are very contemporary, like transformation, like care, like drawing. And I think that all these actions that we were knowing, we can redefine them and actually use them in our teachings and curriculums now. What is incredible is the crafts are much more used, I think, actually in Latin America than in northern countries because of digital developments, and sometimes it's good to bring to students to another realities and to learn together with other cultures.
That sounds very inspiring. So what exactly makes your approach experimental?
Well, this experimental is another way of also thinking the project, because for example, in general, in Europe, what we are doing is that we design the project, then we give to other person to make it, and then there is a company that construct it. So for us, first of all the constructions didn't have an authorship because we are a group. We incorporate in the group an interdisciplinary group like students, teachers, researchers, and we don't have a really plan. So every time that we go, we don't begin by the design, but we, in a way, put together the designing and the making is together. And we, in a way, work building fragments and testing things. Sometimes, after a summer, part of the things that we built, it has to be dismantled, but we assume it. And it's experimental because it doesn't have to finish in a way. We really try to test the materials that we have, but we never know every time that we were there that it's gonna work. So we did not design the things in Switzerland and arrive to Chile, sino we designed together. And there is this kind of playing jazz, as David Jolie said, together, that yes, it was experimental because we didn't know really what we were going to do.
Can you maybe, because we talked today also about utopias or utopian potential, can you elaborate on the utopian or maybe transformational potential that lies within such a design approach as you mm-hmm. practice it?
First of all, I think that there is a relation with the land, that if you put students, Swiss students, directly in contact with the desert, in the sand, and they have to build in the sand, and with no so much very low technologies and very local practices and no budget, you have to use a lot of imagination. So first of all, I think there is a question. It's how we touch the ground. Yes, very simple, but it's about the foundations. Also, it's about the materials that we use. Because in a way, we were also testing this kind of light constructions with local materials that talks about this ephemeral architecture. An architecture that it can grow, an architecture that it can change. And then this came this idea about the construction as a garden, no? Because you have to take care, but it can change. And then there is this full equilibrium in between the nature and the architecture. And I think in this sense, there is a lot to learn about this experience, because sometimes do we need to build all the time for a building that is going to be 50 years? So perhaps there is another way of building more lighter, building more changeable, that perhaps the houses can grow and different materials. I don't know, there is something to question altogether, which is the best solution. But what is very strong is also to be all the time in relation with the outside, working outside, and each year seeing how the materials are getting older and how they change. It was very inspiring for all of us.
And now, just out of curiosity, how are the building and the construction cultures in Switzerland and in Central and South America, and what are like the main differences if you compare it directly?
Well, I have to say that Latin America is very, very big, but I of course I'm half Cuban, so I live in Switzerland and I teach here for a long time. But I really feel as an hybrid person, so I think that there is a lot of fantastic things that we can learn. I work a lot with Chile and with Brazil, that they have a very strong cultural links with Europe, because it was also the modernist and a lot of different exchanges. But it's clear that the climate is very different. And for example, in Brazil, that I was in Sao Paulo, the modernism and the way they relate with nature, because of the climate, is much more open. It's, here, the problem in Switzerland is also, it's not a problem, but you have a lot of different climates. So the building has to be very efficient because of the nature of the climatic that the building is. But I'm very positive, because I think we can learn from a lot of solutions that you have in Switzerland, because I think the cultural is in Switzerland for architecture is fantastic. But it's very important, I think, if we have to have impact in the future architects, that they also know what is not only built in the north, but also they have to, in a way, see strong cultures in the global south that can be very inspiring and very linked to the craftsmanship that perhaps we are in a little bit missing. I think it's important to have students that they are able to operate in different cultures with very low tech tools or very high tools. So I think these kind of exchanges and different ways of seeing the reality, it only can be positive in the future of a student or a future architect or designer that wants to have an impact in the world.
That sounds like a quite nice perspective for the future and a nice wrap up for our interview. Thank you so much, Patricia. That was very insightful. I hope you enjoyed the festival, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the day, and wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure and very inspiring for me to be here. And I am very, very excited to see how this master continues. And congratulations to all of you for this fantastic day.
Thank you. So, last but not least, the final keynote of the day was held by Dini van den Heuvel. Hello, Dini. Nice to meet you. We just heard a fascinating talk from you about fashion and sustainability, and sustainable fashion and fashionable sustainability. You obviously are very passionate about all these topics. To recall the first words of your presentation, you love fashion. You spoke in length about the formation of your interests. Can you please tell our listeners who were not present, how did this passion arise and what's your story?
So I think it started quite early on. I always had very fashionable clothing. When I was really small, my dad used to make my outfits, and he would always make sure that I could be twinning with my favorite stuffed doll. And then later on, I come from a household which is obsessed with like organic and sustainable. So I would have like the hand-knitted sweaters, which were not the most fashionable at a certain moment, I have to admit. And then I was in a Waldorfschule where we learned how to hand-stitch a doll and make her face and the hair and whatnot. And because I was really eager and I thought this was fascinating, because all of a sudden you see these two-dimensional materials turn into three-dimensional objects, which was like magic in front of me. And I was so eager to get it done that I completely rushed through the assignment. And we had moms in the classroom helping to like support these 18 little wiggly kids that were trying to like master needle and thread. And they would then come to your table and teach you how to measure the doll you made. You need like 3 or 4 measurements, and then you could draft some lines on fabric, cut it out, and it became a dress. And I will never forget this moment, because I went home and I took my measurements and I drew it on a piece of fabric that my mom got from like a, like the most horrible store ever with like drapes and table runners. And I made myself a dress. Because I figured if it fits for the doll, it fits for me. And ever since, I fell in love with it right there and then.
That sounds beautiful. Now, in the abstract for your talk, you say that you love the pace of the fashion industry, and at the same time, sustainability is really important to you. How do you reconcile these two things, or how do you bring them together in your practice?
So what if I say I really love the speed of fashion? I'm not talking about the 52 collections a year. I think that's ludicrous and insane, and nobody actually needs that. What I do appreciate is that fashion is very forgiving, because nobody remembers last season. And it also relieves the stress of making the best collection of your life, because I can make a next collection that is even more spectacular. Or I can decide to try something new this season. And if it doesn't work, then next season I'll change course. So that's something with the speed of fashion that I really like. But at the same time, if I watch and observe how people are consuming it, like it's a throwaway project, like it's a plastic bag, I find that that is one of the biggest problems of the industry. And that's where sustainability is diametrically opposed to the speed of fashion. And I'm on the sustainability side. I want my clothing to last, and I want to build quality. So yes, it might be an experiment this season, but I still hope that the people who purchase it love it and actually wear it for eternity, which will not happen because I make children's clothes and kids grow out of it, but that we then find the next generation and the next generation to really value and love it.
You talk a lot about the fabrics and the materials in connection to sustainability. But at the same time, as you state as well, sustainability is also built into the supply chains at work. To what extent do the questions that need to be asked in those two areas differ, or are they similar?
I think if you start your journey into any area of design, it's normal that you make a mood board and that you make, you have images that inspire you. And in the same way, if you make fashion, there is fabrics that inspire you and colors that inspire you. So in a very physical world, it is the beginning of a garment. But simultaneously, when thinking in terms of sustainability, there are so many more questions about the end of life of the garment that if I want to have a positive impact, I need to design it in the garment. Retro-engineering a better world is so hard, as we all are seeing. So why would I look at the world and figure that retro-engineering systems is incredibly hard and then make the same mistake when designing a garment? You have to make it right from the beginning. It is 100 times easier in the long run.
So a last question, and maybe quite an abstract one, but the numbers and images you've shown in your presentation are quite shocking and saddening. To what extent do you think the fashion industry itself is able to address these issues as like an industry in a capitalist machine? And what kind of universal changes do you think are necessary to reach your utopia, like outside of the fashion industry even? And as a maybe a similar question, how do you fight the status quo, as you stated in the discussion in the end?
So the numbers are really depressing. We buy on average 15 to 16 garments annually per person, which means that if you as a listener buy only 4, somebody else is buying 20, 25. These are averages with huge extremes. And the fashion system as we see it today is a capitalist extractionary system, which is built on colonialism and inequality. And changing that is, within the system, impossible. And what I mean by that is, every time when we see a suggestion which might solve a problem, it gets capitalized, institutionalized, and integrated. We used to have dead stock. Then we figured we can push people to use dead stock. But by commodifying the dead stock, we removed the need for brands to watch carefully and reduce their overproduction. Because all of a sudden, their overproduction can be crazy high because it still has economic value. I can sell it to, I don't know, some students. So it immediately gets integrated. So change within the system, if you only focus on your metrics of success that are coming from the system and from the capitalistic society, is impossible. Because everything you invent, every innovation, every new system, in my opinion, will directly be integrated and optimized for profits. And I think the only way of actually changing this is by changing how you judge the success. Changing how people use, consume, recycle, and think about fashion. And that is a much more foundational shift that will happen in society, which will impact fashion and every other aspect of society. But the fashion system on its own, as long as it keeps being profit-driven, cannot do this. It is complete, in my opinion, for the moment, as I see it, impossible to tackle this problem.
Speaking about utopias as like a word for the day, I think this is a nice wrap-up for our interviews. Thank you so much, Dini, for taking the time to answer those questions and for this interesting conclusion of the day. I wish you all the best and maybe see you around.
Thank you very much.
Was macht ihr da?
Design.
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 Machen.
Machen.
Gesellschaft.
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 Gesellschaft.